Thank you. I've heard a lot tonight that I think I can agree with, a lot I don't agree with. Certainly can't go through it all in 2 minutes. Let me try to get through a couple of points. One inconsistency I just heard was one of our speakers said that overproduction of agricultural crops in the United States is driving third world farmers out of existence, and then I just heard that U.S. farmers are going out of existence. So I'm not quite sure where the problem is there.
Please let him speak. You are all here to hear the people up here. Let them talk.
One thing I do agree with, I heard, is we need to develop local solutions, and that's happening. I don't think we need to put up false choices. We don't need to make a false choice between a conventionally produced rice variety and a transgenic rice variety. They may have different uses in different regions, but you know, let's base the decision on science. Why don't we look at the science? Let's evaluate whether the transgenic rice has some potential to help farmers in these countries. If there are conventional varieties that are better, let's use those varieties. But you know, we need to make these decisions on the basis of science, not on the basis of emotion and rhetoric. And that's what we're asking for. Let's talk about money. Let's talk about the farmers in South Africa and the farmers in the Philippines who are making more money because they're growing crops that they don't need as many pesticides for. Let's talk about the farmers in those countries who don't have to walk out into the fields barefoot to spray pesticides by hand. A part of this forum is sponsored by the Pesticide Action Network. We've demonstrated real reductions in pesticide use in developing countries, and yet some people want to deny the farmers who get the greatest benefit out of this reduction in pesticide use the technology that allows them to do it. How does that make sense? We do need to have debates over this. One more.
Please, come on.
I am here. That's why I'm here.
There are people up on the panel who will answer all of these questions. Please let us talk.
I've heard that farmers can't afford GE crops. Well, as I think I've shown you, there are farmers in the developing world who are growing these GE crops. 90% of the food consumed in the poorest parts of the world is produced locally. Now, to say that these farmers can't afford GE crops is a non sequitur. What they need is to grow their own food. And if this technology can help them do it better, then why do you want to deny it to them? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
David Hegwood is the counsel to U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Ann Veneman. Amadou Kanute of Consumers International Zimbabwe.
The very last reading I did before I came to this meeting has been some sort of a double eye-opener for me. And I would like just to take my 2 minutes to read you, to go through this text, and maybe what I will be reading will be answering some of the issues that have been raised. The very first, well, I'm reading from a document done by Aaron Degrassi, and he is from the Institute of Development Studies, University of Sussex, Brighton. He is saying, looking at what has been used to showcase how successful the small-scale producers in South Africa have been by adopting GE technology in cotton or sweet potatoes in Kenya, here is what he is saying. He is saying that the amount of labor saved is unclear. In fact, farmers spend more money on the engineered seeds, which are twice as expensive as conventional ones, than they save on reducing pesticides. Then, it goes on saying, and there I will really need to be educated. It goes on saying that about how much profit the small-scale producers are making, we've got such an array of figures that I am at a loss. It is saying crop gene says farmers gain 113 per hectare. Monsanto says farmers gain an extra $90. ISAAA argues that switching to BT allows farmers make an extra $50 per hectare. University researchers calculate $35 per hectare, while the survey team found farmers gained only $18 in the second year. But in the first year, BT cotton non-adopters were actually $1 per hectare better off. Which figure should I go for? Then the last point I would like to make, and which is also very important, it is why are we insisting so much on the alternatives that are more, that are appropriate in terms of technology, in terms of level of development, in terms of know-how, in terms of just making the farmers control what they want to produce, how they want to produce it, and just to master their own future. It is saying here, with regard to the cost effectiveness of developing the modified sweet potatoes, maximum gains in yield increase from resistance are estimated on the basis of interviews largely with project staff to be 18%. This is sweet potatoes in Eastern Africa, Kenya. The sweet potato project is now nearing its 12th year and involves over 19 scientists, among which 16 are PhDs, and an estimated cost of $6 million. In contrast, conventional sweet potatoes breeding in Uganda was able in just a few years to develop with a small budget a well-liked virus-resistant variety with yield gains of nearly 100%.
Thank you very much.
Amadou Kanute of Consumers International in Zimbabwe.
Thank you. One point I wanted to build upon is the issue of sort of corporate control and sort of image that has been painted of companies sort of controlling the food chain. I think it's, and talk about reality, I think I'd like to bring probably a little bit of a reality check here. I think it's very important to realize here that what we're talking about here is first of all, is the seed industry. We're not talking about the food chain. We're talking about the seed industry. It's quite important to realize that the percentage of biotechnology seed compared to conventional seed is very, very small. Second is that in a country like India has been mentioned, for example, there are still about 200 seed companies, and there is a number of very important state-owned companies, and therefore a lot of seed production still is in the public sector. The other point is also, and so I think it's important to realize that, you know, owning a patent is different from owning a seed. And that a patent has been essentially designed for two things. One is to promote innovation, and the second thing is to, you know, ensure that the knowledge from that innovation is being disclosed, I think, to essential public goods. And that in return for that, for those two things, the inventor does indeed enjoy the monopoly for the commercialization of that of his invention for a limited period of time, and therefore after that limited period of time. So I think it's very important to, you know, realize that when some people sort of painted a sort of very doomed scenario that we'll, you know, what we eat will all be controlled by a handful or even only one company. And I think that's important. The second probably point I wanted to mention, and you know, I guess probably in defense of my colleague on my left here, is about a regulatory assessment. It's been said that the trials are being conducted by companies, and yes, that is true. But that's how the regulatory system is being designed, is that those that develop, no, but it's been designed like that for a number of technologies, for pharmaceuticals, for example, as well. Now, and so, you know, you may disagree with that, and there may be other ways to that, and that the development of the technology is entirely in the hands of the government. And I think that system has been tried, you know, before as well, with the results that we know. There are a number of controls in the development of those products, and thereafter there is a thorough assessment, you know, by the regulatory authorities. So, I mean, painting the view that because the trials are being carried out by the developing company, that as a result of that, the results are not credible or biased is something that has to be corrected. There are a number of control processes in the development of those particular technology, and there is a fully fledged assessment in this particular country by three agencies to assess the safety and the efficacy of the technology. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And finally, that was Christian Gershon of CropLife International. This is Anuradha Mittal of Food First.
Of leaving it up to science to decide for us if we should be using this technology and the system that has been explained to us in terms of regulatory agencies, it's like giving a key to the bank, to the bank robber, and asking the bank robber to guard it for us. So the other way the science is working in this country is by saying we don't need to label these foods because they're just like any other food, the food that you've had before, and then run to the patent office to saying it's really different, we need a patent on it. So I would just say that more than science, I think what we really need is to respect the sovereign right of farmers. For example, farmers in the Philippines have been mentioned who've been on a hunger strike demanding the complete moratorium on commercial planting and of GE crops. So if we actually listen to the farmers' movements, I think we would know what the farmers really want, since they have been the keepers of our seeds and taken care of, the best stewards of the land. Also, give the right to the third world countries to have their own process. We saw in the case of Sri Lanka, when it tried to put a ban on imports of GE crops, a lot of pressure coming from the WTO to USAID. We have seen the same kind of pressure on Zambia and other African nations and all kind of arm-twisting tactics. Let the third world alone and let them go through their own regulatory process, because we have seen that process fail in the United States with the Starlink corn, when corn not meant for human consumption got into a food system, leading to a recall of more than 300 corn-based products. Last December, we saw corn genetically engineered to stop dairy and piglets get mixed in a food system. So we know the regulatory agencies have failed in the United States, and we want to be able to work with our own regulatory agencies and come up with our own process.
That was Anuradha Mittal of Food First. And you are tuned to a special presentation, a live debate on agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology.
Can go to all sides of this. And it gets to it's about labeling. This is one of the big complaints now, one of the big divisions. A number of people say, why not just label the foods? If the foods are so good, why not let them label? In fact, one questioner says, why doesn't industry get behind labeling as a marketing tool? To let people do that. And as some background on this, it's important to know that at least in the past, a number of countries, especially in Europe, have required labeling. The United States government's official position, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, and the industry's position has been to be against labeling. So if I could begin with that, and let me ask perhaps Dr. Fishorn to begin. Why wouldn't the industry favor labeling?
I think first of all, the question is fairly complex when you look at it on a global basis. If the question you will have to ask is essentially to the food industry, because I think what you're asking here is the technology industry, whether it is in favor or not in favor of labeling, whilst in fact that question needs to be addressed to the food industry. And you get very different answer depending on which region you find yourself into. In generally, what we have said is that labeling must have a purpose. And in the sense of addressing a question in terms of providing information to to the consumer in the sense of whether there are some, you know, health, you know, consequences where there is substantial equivalence, substantial difference. The, you know, there is a reason for the agency providing a, you know, a mandatory labeling. For the other cases, essentially what we're saying is we need to leave the food chain, the actors in the food chain, to decide, you know, what is most appropriate in relation to labeling.
Let me follow up here with Amadou. As someone who has been skeptical of biotechnology, would you accept biotechnology if it were labeled?
Other factors are really important to take into account, particularly when it comes to... Right. Why are we asking for labeling? First, to exercise the right to choice. That is one. Why are people after choice in this particular case? It's because the models of production behind GE are seen by people as not being sustainable. So the labeling here, and that's precisely why industry is not very open to getting labels on the product. It is precisely because people are very concerned about what impact it is going to have on their environment. People are concerned about health aspect. People are concerned about sustainability, being able to produce food after the GE technology has been introduced in the environment. So all those aspects are really the real reason why industry seems to be saying no. We are saying, if your product is a novel product, if your product is something that you think is bringing a plus to consumers, then go ahead and label it. When you label it, then people can make a choice depending on other aspects that they think are important. So these two things should actually go together. Once you label, then you are able to decide whether you want to go for it or not.
Thank you very much. We'll go to Marmota Pellegrosso's question here, and there's a second one from another person that raises the precautionary principle. Is the basic scientific precautionary principle taken into consideration when you decide to push ahead with the development and marketing of GE seeds? A. B. Who will be held responsible for any possible damage caused by these products? And finally, from another person, if we discover later that GE food is dangerous after it has been introduced into the environment, how will we recall it? Professor McLaughlin, could you take a stab at that, please?
Sure. Actually, this leads back to the issue of labeling, because, in fact, labeling is required. If there is an issue of potential increased toxicity, modification of nutrients, in potential allergenicity, or change in complexity of the food itself. And I'll give you an example from Davis with respect to substantial equivalence and precautionary principle. I'm not sure if we have any tomato farmers here, but for processing tomatoes, high soluble solids are a big requirement. And we took two approaches to producing this in Davis. One, using a traditional method where we crossed it with a wild variety of tomato that has high soluble solids. It has a lot of things that you don't want: small size, poor taste, bad flavor, and it's toxic. And it took us 18, 19 years of back crossing to get rid of the components that actually express the toxic genes. Now, using biotech, we see the same thing. We didn't introduce any foreign genes. We turned off a gene that switches from what's called a xylose producer to a sucrose producer. The interesting thing is the product that's out there is the one that was crossed with the toxic genes, and this was done using a traditional system. The biotech one is regulated up the wazoo and is going through the process of deregulation at this point in time. The point I'm trying to make there is the one that was produced traditionally, because it was done through conventional breeding,
it wasn't taken into consideration that it was crossed with a toxic gene, with a plant that produced that had genes for high glycoalkaloids. So the notion is that you need to look at the product itself, with respect to safety and potential negative environmental impact. That's the component that you need to look at. The example I gave earlier of zucchini, again, looked perfectly healthy, looked really good, in fact, it was big and green. But the reason it was big and green, it was producing its own pesticide, again, a glycoalkaloid, cucurbitacin. And because it wasn't sprayed, it was helping itself to keep the insects off. So with any system, because plants are not benign, they can't run away. They produce an awful lot of nasty things. About 90% actually of carcinogens come from plants. So we have to look at the system that is most appropriate to ensure the safety and efficacy of the product itself and the environment.
Thank you very much. I'm told now that we do have some microphones in the audience, so I'm going to invite up a couple of people to do that, and in the meantime, I'll pose one, while they're making their way to the mics, I'll pose one more question that's been put by a number of people. Oh, I'm sorry. Please. I hear you. You must think that we're deaf up here. I don't know. Yeah, there were some other questions about the precautionary principle, and I sensed that Anuradha wanted to step in, so why don't you take a shot at those. In the meantime, may I ask, please, that Mr. George Naylor and Ms. Caroline Lucas find your way to the
Anuradha Mittal of Food First will be speaking.
I would just answer in terms of who is responsible. The insurance industry is not providing insurance to the corporations for putting the products out there, and the farmers are the ones who are signing contracts. Basically, if anything goes wrong, it'll be the farmers who will be responsible, not the insurance industry, not the corporations, but our farmers.
And the question of recalling is brought up. How do we recall it if it turns out that we made a mistake?
Again, getting back to the point I made, the system that you use, you look at the cost to benefits at the particular point in time. With these crops, they have been more thoroughly studied than any in the history of scientific research. There was a discussion about maize earlier. Maize is highly unstable. 50% of the maize genome is made up of jumping genes, as determined by Barbara McClintock back in the 1940s. And in fact, that's where you get all the interesting kernels. The point I'm trying to make here is that you're working with a system, using traditional systems, or using mutation. I talked about the fact that all of our spaghetti is produced using irradiation mutagenesis with cobalt-60 to modify the paste consideration for semolina production. All of the Asian pears out there that are resistant against black spot disease were produced, again, using mutagenesis. So there's all these systems out there with imprecise methods and imprecise technologies, but nobody ever looked at them before. And when you look at these, they look over time, where specific considerations such as the issues with potatoes or tomatoes where you have glycoalkaloids, or zucchinis with glycoalkaloids, you look at those issues. You make the best possible decision at that point in time. I'll give myself an example. I have an autoimmune disease. I take a biotechnology product that's keeping me alive. I'm not sure if it may kill me eventually, but it went through huge, exhaustive tests by the company. It was regulated, but by the company itself. It was patented so that I could actually get it. But the point I'm trying to make is you look at the decision you have at any point in time. You look at the risks, you look at the benefits, and you make decisions based on that.
Okay.
So do you think...
We have your questions here.
McLaughlin, please don't shout.
You can all decide whether she's answered.
You're tuned to community-supported radio, KBMR-FM, a special live
Caroline Lucas, are you at the microphone? Yes. Why don't you speak up?
Is it on? Okay. My name's Caroline Lucas. I'm a member of the European Parliament for the Greens, and we're doing our best to keep GM out of Europe at the moment. But I had two questions for David Hegwood. The first is that he's talked a lot about how concerned the U.S. government is about poverty in developing countries. And so my first question is, would he not agree that changing the rules of the World Trade Organization, which actually have a much greater impact on reducing poverty and reducing hunger in developing countries than investing in biotech, because the rules of the World Trade Organization, the rules of the WTO agreement on agriculture are fundamentally about breaking down the barriers in developing countries and forcing through our exports into those markets and undermining the markets of those people there. And my second question is, if biotech is as safe as you say it is, why are the GM companies doing all they can and lobbying me and my compatriots in the European Parliament as much as they can to avoid legislation on liability?
Well, first to the question about WTO rules. I'm not sure what rules you would suggest that we change. In fact, most developing countries did very little to open up their markets to imports as a result of the Uruguay round. Most of them were exempt from substantial reductions in their tariff commitments. So there hasn't been a tremendous influx of imports from the developed world to the developing countries as a result of the WTO rules. So I would suggest that, you know, if you're really interested in that subject, that you look at the data and see if there really is a problem there. In fact, what developing countries need is economic growth, and one facet of economic growth comes through export earnings. These countries need markets for the products that they produce in order to earn income. I'm not going to solve all the world's problems tonight, okay? So we can't, you can't isolate a country from the global economy and then expect it to grow. It doesn't work that way. So, if you want to have a specific discussion about how WTO rules are going to impact developing countries, that's what we're doing in Geneva with the Doha Development Agenda, which is focused on how we find solutions to help developing countries participate in the global economy, not be excluded from the global economy. And the second question was liability. I don't know why the companies are lobbying you about liability rules. What I do know is that the United States, the European Union, and most other developed economies have legal systems that already accommodate some notion of liability. It may not be to everybody's satisfaction, but it's a very complex subject, and I suspect that in starting to talk about how you would change liability rules to deal with risks that are not even foreseeable, risks that may not even exist, because we're talking about a precautionary principle that takes as its premise that something in the future could go wrong, and we don't need any proof right now that that may happen, so we can impose liability on somebody just in case that fate works out that way. You have to have a better basis for liability than that. It's a very complex legal issue, and I think it's something that probably does need to be debated, but it needs to be debated in those terms.
Is George Naylor at the mic?
Yes, George Naylor, a farmer.
Yeah. Hi. I'll try to present a less complex legal issue for you. I'm a corn and soybean farmer in Iowa, and I try to raise non-GMO crops for sale. And my neighbors, of course, occasionally raise GMO corn. And when they buy Monsanto's varieties, they get what's called a technology user guide. And in that guide, it says, well, yeah, it's just nearly impossible to prevent GMO pollen from drifting and contaminating other crops. Therefore, my neighbors are supposed to inform me that I'm supposed to have a buffer. Okay? Now, so far, none of my neighbors have voluntarily told me that they are raising GMO crops. I usually have to go ask them if they are and where they're located. Now, could you explain to me why? Well, and another point is that I was just in Vermont this last winter visiting farmers, and I met many organic farmers whose farms were so small that if their neighbor raised GMO corn, they would not be able to raise organic corn on their farms. Now, could you explain the legal intricacies of why I am supposed to provide the buffer and why Monsanto is not responsible for contaminating my crop?
Yeah.
You're tuned to a live debate from the Press Theater on biotechnology, hunger, and agriculture.
This is why the government pays you those big bucks, David.
The short answer is no, I can't answer that question. I don't have an answer for that question. It's an issue that is becoming of increasing importance at the department. It's not one that I have been personally involved in to date. But it is one that I can promise you that we will look into. I will take it back. And we'll look at it.
Is there anyone else here on the panel who could speak to that? Why is it that farmers have to carry the risk?
Actually, one of the best ways to control it is Terminator technology. Because with hybrid corn, it's going to stop the gene flow. The next generation of plants are actually being produced using what's called chloroplast transformation. So the chloroplast is sort of the ultimate feminist organelle. It goes through the mother, it goes down the mother line, it doesn't get into the pollen. So the actual genes will be retained within the mother plant. It isn't absolutely perfect. You may sometimes get some backcrossing to the genome, but it is like 99% perfect. But male sterility, corn male sterility, is one of the best possible ways to control this. And the decision to not allow GM was the organic farmer's decision, and I don't understand why. My friend from who's married to an organic farmer, her husband, who's an organic farmer, says he doesn't understand that decision either. But the decision, as I said, was by the organic farmers to decide that GM wasn't organic, and I don't understand why myself as to why that decision was made.
Sylvia Ribeiro will speak to a second, but first may I ask Monica Moore and Andrew Geller to come to the microphones.
That was Martina McLaughlin of UC Davis.
I am kind of sensitive on Terminator because before
Ribeiro.
We were called Etcetera Group, we are Rafi, and we discovered a patent on Terminator. And we have been following the development on this. And Terminator is a technology for making suicide seeds. And what Martina is suggesting here is that because they have a bad technology that they don't know how they will put an even worse technology that we will suffer for all of us. So all the crops will have both the one technology but also the other ones, and then you will have a change of different genes that can get separated from each other, in fact, and produce they don't know what. But because Terminator is not so very good neither, they will add something else that will take both Terminator and the other, which is called the Exorcist now, we have called it so, which is another... This is true. So what is incredible is that for the profit of really, really very few corporations, we all have to suffer and being subject to be guinea pigs of these kind of experiments, and also accept that Terminator is good for biosafety to the cost of food sovereignty, of food security for all of us. That's completely unacceptable.
That was Sylvia Ribeiro of ETC.
Monica Moore at the microphone.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Monica Moore with Pesticide Action Network, North America, and also Pan International. My question is for Dr. Christian. Many panelists have mentioned, and we hear frequently, that one of the justifications for this is that it will reduce the use of pesticides. And in fact, pesticide poisoning is a major, major public health threat throughout the world, this country included, but certainly in the developing world. So my question is, quite apart from genetic engineering technologies, would CropLife International be willing to commit tonight to say that their member companies should no longer produce class 1A, 1B, and class 2 pesticides, which are responsible for the vast majority of poisonings throughout the world, simply stop producing, selling, and pulling them back, which would do more to end and to certainly to reduce the pesticide poisoning that has been mentioned as a justification here.
Thank you for that question. I think it's the issue of pesticides poisoning is one that is a lot of concern to us and one that we have been trying to address for a number of years, and I'll come to that in a moment. First of all, it's important to realize the complexity of that issue, particularly in developing countries. All complex solution, there's usually one very simple and wrong solution. So if you allow me to explain a little bit and elaborate a little bit on the complexity of that particular issue. But if you want to have a short answer, is that there's answers there is in two forms. One is strengthening regulatory regimes into developing countries, and this is something that CropLife International, through our network of association, have been collaborated with FAO and with the local government in putting in place solid regulatory frameworks. The second answer to that is proper stewardship. And you probably know, and I'm sure your organization is aware, that since 1991 now, when the organization was called GCPF, we have initiated safe use programs all around the world, starting with pilot programs in Thailand, Guatemala, and Kenya, and expanding these programs into the rest of developing countries. This being said, we need to do more, and we actually have engaged with the dialogue and would like to have a more of a dialogue with the Pesticide Action Network and other organizations to try to see what other measures we can take. In terms of the... Thank you. At least I can go home and say it was a successful night. But we will look into that, that particular matter, and invite the Pesticide Action Network and Barbara Dinham in particular to discuss that. Thank you.
Christian Verschuren,
is Andrew Geller at
CropLife International.
This is for you too, and I'll shorten the question that was up there. Given the issue of genetic drift that George Naylor brought up, and independent non-governmental organization studies and research about increased use of pesticides, Percy Smizer here could talk about that in Saskatchewan with canola, and lower, not higher, yields of transgenic crops. Can you still stand behind your statement in your first segment that there is no cause for concern about biotech agricultural crops?
Trying to remember your question exactly. Okay. The question of genetic or pollen drift. Two parts to that. One, is there an environmental risk? Is there a health and safety risk? That we can address and do address through the regulatory system. We can, once we have determined that the product is safe, that it creates no environmental risk, that it creates no health and safety risk, then the pollen drift no longer becomes a health and safety concern. All right. Now, the next part of that is there some other reason to be concerned about pollen drift? Mr. Naylor's concern was that it impacted his organic production. All right. Well, that's not a health and safety issue. That's not an environmental issue. That's a marketing issue. That's a question of whether this farmer is going to realize the full value of his crop. It's not a question of whether his crop is any less safe. It's a question of whether he gets the premium for growing an organic crop. So do I stand by my statement that it's safe? Yes. I stand by my statement that if it's been through our regulatory system, that it's safe.
About whether or not you thought it was safe, it was whether or not you thought there was any cause for concern.
Well,
I'm quoting you earlier.
Did I say actually no
yes.
cause for concern?
Yes, I'm a journalist. I get quotes very.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly believe you. In that case, let me say that the context for saying no cause for concern was the health and safety and environmental risk context, not the commercial context. Is there a commercial issue? Yes, obviously there's a commercial issue there.
Okay, let me ask Steve Wirtz, please, to come to
that was David Hegwood of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And Angus Wright, here speaking as another journalist, to the critics of genetically modified foods. I was listening today to the Forum program on KQED, and Peter Pringle, British journalist, has a book out now called Food Incorporated, in which he has looked at the entire industry of GE food and at the critics. And Anuradha Mittal was on that program as well. And Mr. Pringle made a point, I believe, that that there's a lot of possible benefits to come out of genetically modified food, as well as a lot of problems. And in his view, the difficulty was, is there a way that the technology could be properly regulated by government agencies? So let me put the question to the three critics here. Can you, would you completely rule out the possibility of genetically modified crops ever playing a role in agriculture and therefore hunger issues around the world if you yourselves could be the ones designing the regulatory process and overseeing the regulatory process? Would you shut the door entirely in a sort of a Luddite position, or would you? Do you believe that the problem is one that could be fixed with intelligent and empathetic regulation? Anuradha Mittal.
Well, I think the rationale that's been presented to us that we need this technology to feed the third world, we would need, first of all, a real reason as to why we need this technology, because we do not need this technology to feed the third world. Second would be we would need to follow precautionary principle, and we would need to have real evidence that it is really safe. And the problem, as we have seen with the revolving door policy, we have seen our regulatory agencies not doing their jobs. That evidence is not about to come in, because we are being told right now that it is safe, that there is no need for concern around environment and around health concerns. So given that factor, that we do not have precautionary principle, it will not be acceptable. Thirdly, till we can ensure that people have, that we go through a real public debate and discussion is allowed, that if we really want this technology, we do live in democracies. We cannot allow a handful of people to make those decisions for us. Even in this country, this food got into our market shelves without a public debate. So we would need a public debate, and if the people really want this technology, and I think if a decent rationale is indeed presented, you know, we would see where it goes with that. So till that happens, we're not about to budge on it. At least I'm not.
Mm-hmm. And Sylvia Ribeiro, you are the regulator. You are the regulator. You get to run it. Would you allow it?
Well, I wouldn't like to be a regulator for anyone in the sense that I think that one of the main things that has been that has been alienated from all of us is the real control of our lives in almost anything and almost all aspects. And I couldn't be a regulator for any other people, rather than try to recuperate the real empowerment of local communities to decide which kind of food, which kind of agriculture, which kind of industries they would like to have. Having said that, I have to say that genetic engineering in particular, I think is a technology that is so uncertain, that there are so many things that are unknown, the consequences about genetic engineering, that I think preliminary that this is a technology that should completely disappear. That's my view on the issue. This is because it's a technology which is completely artificial, that is crossing realms that could never have been crossed. and that would never cross in reality, that is completely unaware of the long-term effects and also the effects on not only the biodiversity in the environment, but also the diversity within the genome and the interactions in the genomes and the genomes with others. So I think this is a technology that should be banned.
And Aminu Kanute, same question.
The African countries have come up with a model law on biotechnology. And that model law, as it stands now, has all the provisions that would allow what the farmer was talking about, which is, in case of liability, allowing the one whose products have contaminated the other one to pay for that. The same model law also has the possibility for us, when we are not happy with something, to have a class action. The same model law says that both for import and export, there should be prior consent of the recipient country of the type of food that is coming in or that is being exported. That model law also provides for mandatory labeling. So here are some specific aspects that we have been asking for, which unfortunately are being undermined by the pro-GM lobby. They are now coming up and saying, we need to develop an alternative to the African model law. While it is this law, this model, that we think really takes into account all the concerns that are being raised both by the farmers, consumers, governments, small-scale farmers, and so on. So what we are saying here is, we are in a market, and market, when they are deficient, when they are not effective, you need to come up with regulations. And this model law, which is now being undermined, is the one that we would like to see being enacted instead of it being undermined by the pro-GM lobby.
Well, I appreciate being here tonight listening to a debate, and I appreciate having a chance to ask a question. I'm sure there's many more to ask. I've been around long enough, unfortunately, to have heard about the Green Revolution in the 50s and at a time when I was studying malnutrition. And unfortunately, today I come to you, as someone else already said, that there are 25,000 young children under five that die each day in the world from malnutrition and hunger and simple diseases that are solved very simply if we had a better distribution system. The Green Revolution was sold as the modern solution of science solving problems. And unfortunately, it was sold in large part by scientists. I'm a scientist, and I feel my question is, how do we hold scientists and politicians responsible for making unrealistic and undocumented claims for such things that did not pan out the way they were intended?
So, how do we hold scientists and politicians accountable for decisions like biotechnology? We will start down at the end and carry on this way.
Okay, well, it's going to be difficult to conclude on that.
Christian Verschuren of CropLife International.
The results did not pan out the way it was supposed to be. That's not exactly true. I think what we did see in terms of the Green Revolution is in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, considerable increase in yield and considerable reduction in poverty, and I believe, you know, despite what Anuradha might say, I think including in India. What I think we did see is after that, in the 90s, you see a growing population, et cetera, and we see that no longer the needs are being met. And resolving the complex issue of poverty reduction is a very complex one. And it's, I mean, I would agree with that. I think technology is definitely not part of the solution. But trying to address the issue of the distribution systems has failed as well. And what I believe the consensus is from what I've read and I've, you know, talked to several people as well, is that we need to increase the purchasing power, the disposable income of the people, of the rural poor, of the people in the rural community, so that they have a higher disposable income. And that can be done by, among other things, also by increasing yield, and technology, and particularly gene technology, can be a solution, a part of that solution, I think, in increasing, you know, the revenues and the status of these people into the rural communities, as it has done, indeed, in the early phases of the rural revolution. And what we need now is a second wave of green revolution in that area.
Let me quickly, for our radio listeners, just rephrase this quickly. The question we're dealing with at the end here is the biotech revolution a replay of the green revolution, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? And how do you hold scientists and politicians responsible for those kinds of big decisions?
By some estimates, the Green Revolution...
David Hegwood, U.S. Department of Agriculture.
If that's a failure, then I don't know how we're going to ever make progress on these issues. Science and technology don't stand still. They continue to evolve. We continue to learn. And we need to learn the lessons of the Green Revolution and the people it didn't help. It passed Africa by. It saved 1 billion lives, but there are still 800 million people that are chronically hungry today. There's more to do. There's always more to do. And we need every tool we can get. Should people be held responsible for that? For making claims like that, I think that's for public opinion to decide. But how do you hold somebody responsible for saving 1 billion lives, but he didn't save the other 800 million?
Thank you very much. Amadou Kanute.
I will answer both as a consumer and as a citizen. As a consumer, I will decide not to buy the product and vote the product out of the market. And then there I'm punishing the industry, the corporation, and the scientists who put the product on the market, who developed it, who did the research and development, and marketed it. As a citizen, I would have the same reaction, the same behavior than with the product. Politicians, they come to us with plans, with programs, and they are elected on that ground. When a politician makes a mistake, and the mistake has far-reaching consequences, the public has to make the decision on whether or not we want to get them out of the market, out of the decision-making position in which we elected them earlier on.
Thank you very much. Sylvia Rivera. Yeah.
I don't think that the biotechnology or genetic engineering is continuing the Green Revolution. In a way, it is completely following the Green Revolution because they are the same companies. It's exactly the same companies, all the companies I mentioned before, is the same agrochemical companies that brought us the Green Revolution, and now they're selling transgenics saying that they will use less of their own agrochemicals. It's just to connect this with one thing that was said before. In fact, pharmaceutical, agrochemical, and seeds companies, and more of the same the whole time. And they are the same companies that brought us the patent system all over the world through the imposition of the World Trade Organization, through the Uruguay Round, through the TRIPS agreement, the trade-related intellectual property agreements. And they are the same companies, the pharmaceutical companies that then got merged with agrochemical and seed companies. So they are the same companies, they have the same idea, and in that sense, there is a continuation. It's not... I should say that the biotech, or not the biotech, the genetic engineering revolution is very different because the Green Revolution was working with hybrids that could have some kind of regulation through the environment. The transgenics are, so to say, cheating the environment. The nature doesn't know how to handle this. So this is much more hazardous than the Green Revolution. But the companies are the same. It is a continuation in the same way. And in fact, the Green Revolution has not, I don't know how is the criteria about saying that it saved lives, but for sure it has displaced millions and millions of farmers from the lands, and this has caused much more disease and hunger than any technological fix. So I couldn't let the decision to connect with the politicians and science, I couldn't let the decision on any of these aspects in our life to the scientists as they are today. I think that one main thing we have to do is to recuperate the social orientation of science, which is totally, totally apart from society. Science today is working for corporations, 90%.
Thank you very much. We have two left, and then we're going to have to scoot out of here. Martina McLaughlin, please.
Well, I'm neither a politician nor an industrial scientist. I'm a mere academic, and believe me, if you're in academia, it's not for the money. You're there because you love the science and what it can do, and I passionately believe that this technology can be used with other technologies that are specific to local regions to improve the quality of life, the quality of the environment for people in these areas. And I think it is a crime against humanity for any of us to deprive people of whatever means is going to help them to improve their quality of life in a sustainable manner.
Thank you very much. And Anuradha Mittal.
I disagree with some of my colleagues here, but first of all, I want to thank them and say thank you very much for joining us here tonight. Okay, now this is where I disagree. In terms of Green Revolution, at the height of the Green Revolution, food production increased by 17%. But if you remove China from the picture, hunger also increased around the world by 19%. And that's because China went through land reform and other things. So as long as you do not deal with that, any technological fix is not going to solve the problem of hunger. And as Sylvia has pointed out, you see more destruction of livelihoods. And it's not surprising in my country, India, that farmers have been consuming pesticides to take their own lives because we don't have markets. The crops are standing there, and they have huge big debts, and when faced with a dead end, some opt for death. In terms of how to make politicians and scientists responsible, I would agree with Amadou in terms of politicians. Vote them out of office if they do not represent what I believe in. But when it comes to scientists, I would say before we hold them responsible, we have to free them from corporate influence. Our California state universities... As long as state universities, for example, UC Berkeley, getting only 30% of its funding from state, as long as they're financially strapped, the research agendas will be determined by Novartis, by Monsanto's, who are funding UC Berkeley. So before we move into the arena of holding them, you know, accountable, we have to ensure that our research budgets, instead of creating a police state, actually go into our education system.
That was Anuradha Mittal of Food First, and we are concluding our evening of agriculture.
We've been listening to a debate on biotechnology and world hunger that took place on June 23rd in Sacramento, California. Thanks to Mike Thornton and community radio station KVMR in Nevada City, California, for making this recording of their live broadcast available to us. You can contact us through our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org.